10 days ago, the Wall Street Journal had a book review of a work done by a University of California Berkeley psychologist named Charlie Nemeth. His Nemeth did a study of the effect that other people's opinions have on one's own opinions. She noticed how in groups, we all tend to want to go with the majority opinion. They're persuaded by what others think about a certain subject, that people who are inclined to think one way, but hear that their group is going the other way, our natural instinct is to somewhat follow the herd. She did a number of interesting studies in the book that was being reviewed, and one of them was about juries and the conclusions they came to. She learned that juries that had a single dissenting voice or two on them tended to look at more facts than juries that did not have a dissenter. And they tended to look at those facts through more different angles and creatively than jurors who had no one willing to speak up. She learned that later on, in cases where you could determine the facts later as to whether the jury's verdict was accurate or not, that juries that had a dissenting voice, that is a voice that swam against the stream like a salmon swimming back to the spawning grounds of a stream, juries who had a dissenting voice came to more accurate verdicts than juries when people were afraid to speak up and went with the flow. In other words, her advice is saying that it is uncomfortable, but it is good and helpful for people to listen to voices that they don't like, to people that they're not drawn to opinions that you'd rather not have to entertain and think about, and to deal with other folks that you'd rather not deal with and who make you uncomfortable. And her book is called In Defense of Troublemakers. Well, if ever there was a troublemaker who gave a dissenting voice and who when he's in the room with you, is going to say things to make you feel uncomfortable, that you don't want to agree with, that you find hard to listen to, it is Jeremiah the prophet. But he's making us uncomfortable for our good, as I hope I will convince you of over the next few weeks. Here is how his prophecy opens in the Old Testament book of Jeremiah, chapter 1, verse 1. The words of Jeremiah, one of the priests at the town of Anathoth. The word of the Lord came to him in the 13th year of the reign of King Josiah. Anathoth was a small town about 2 miles away from Jerusalem. And God tells us who was king when Jeremiah started preaching. This introduction to his book will be a little bit longer, probably disproportionate to what we'll actually cover in the sermon, but I hope it's a helpful background to you. Israel, everybody knows, is the homeland of the Jewish people in the Old Testament. But it had not always been that way. The Jewish people did not start in the land of Israel, the promised land, the land of Canaan. They started in the land of Egypt. Backbreaking work, sunrise to sunset, over the whips of pharaohs, taskmasters. God chose them, all the people in the earth, to be his, and he rescued them from slavery through Moses. As you know, he brought them through the wilderness, tenderly as his own, and he gave them the land of Canaan, sometimes called the promised land, the land that became the land of Israel. And to do so, God had to expel the people who were already in that land, that is, the Canaanites, who worshiped the vile god Baal. God had married these Israelites, these Jewish people. He had married them at Mount Sinai, where he made an agreement or a covenant with them. They would be his people, he would be their God, in a way that no other race or country or people on the face of the earth would possibly be. There at Mount Sinai in the desert, God gave them his laws so they would know how to live wisely and avoid a whole lot of trouble. He taught them how to worship him because he's a jealous God, and particularly emphasized that it's very, very important that they never worship other gods. Like a husband or a wife who is jealous for all the right reasons, God says, I am jealous for your affections and your heart. Do not ever worship someone else. He said, if you do these things, you will stay in this land of milk and honey, this promised land, for a long, long time, and I will use you as a nation to bring good to all the people on the face of the earth. Well, that's all well and good. But the Israelites had no idea that the place where God had planted them in Israel was an absolute powder keg of a spot on the map, and that it would take all their faith in order to be able to follow Jehovah in that good land. The reason is this. The nation of Israel is very much like an hourglass. Hourglass is wide at the top, narrow in the middle, wide at the bottom. The area in which Israel lived was all kinds of big nations, north and east of them, west. Then little narrow Israel, through which all the big powers had to pass, and then south of them, strong nations, in particular, the nation of Egypt. So, whenever the big powers were interested in conquering the world, as they always were, they always had to pass through little Israel in order to get where they were going. It was a strategic place. Here was this tiny nation that had to fend off these huge, monstrous regimes just in order to keep their head above the water. And so the Israelites were going to have to learn, were they going to depend upon Jehovah to protect them in this highly vulnerable land, or would they rely on, let's say, foreign gods, idols, that they might think might be stronger than Jehovah? Or would they rely on some kind of political alliance with some pagan nation that didn't give two pennies to put together for Jehovah? Or would they rely strictly on the God who brought them there? Now, the history of this country, Israel, once they went into the land, is largely told in the Old Testament books of Kings and Chronicles. 1st and 2nd Kings, 1st and 2nd Chronicles. And these books organize the history of Israel according to what happened under each king. Here was this king, what happened in his time, here was this king, and what happened in his time, and so forth. And the book of Kings and Chronicles tells of the ups and downs of the people of Israel. Now, I'm sorry to say that there were more downs than ups in their national life. Both spiritually, they had more downs, and militarily and politically, they had more downs. To start with, very early on, they had a civil war. Just like in America, the North was against the South, and they split, and they became two countries that never united again. The Northern country kept the name of Israel. The southern part of the country, now separate, had the name of Judah. It was in Judah that Jeremiah ministered in the city of Jerusalem. Now, as I say, both the northern country Israel and the southern country Judah really did poorly spiritually from very early on. And as they were declining, God began to send them warnings through the mouths of prophets. These prophets did have some things to say about the future, but primarily what they were sent for was to warn Israel to stop their decline, to get their spiritual act together, to stop drifting toward other gods that Jehovah hates, to stop living a life that disobeys all his laws, to live in a way that's wise and helpful and good and pleasing to God, and then God would take care of them. These prophets would get direct words from God. I mean, God would appear to them in their minds and tell them just what they should say. And the last 17 books of the Old Testament are books named after prophets who were sent to the Israelites. So the books of Kings and Chronicles and the books of the prophets parallel each other. Whenever you read a book written by a prophet, almost always it mentions at the beginning what king was living during the time of that prophecy. So you go back to Kings and Chronicles, find out what's going on, and that's the background to make the prophetic books make sense. Otherwise, they tend not to make any sense at all. And the sad reality of it is that Israel, almost uniformly, with some few exceptions, just ignored everything these prophets were saying. Thank you, that's a very nice sermon, appreciate your advice. I think I'll go back to living the way I was. Thank you. The result was, then, that the prophets oversaw a time when God increasingly turned on the spigot of hot water to pressure them because of their sins. Wave after wave of foreign invaders came as Israel and Judah both were in decline. Sometimes those foreign invaders were little countries, nibbling around the edges of the borders, more an irritation than anything else, but just driving you crazy because you can never relax. Sometimes those invasions came from monstrous, the huge empires, and Israel and Judah felt themselves going down the maw of some terrible international lion. Now, the biggest lion to date, when Jeremiah came and gobbled up a large portion of God's people, happened about 100 years before Jeremiah started his work. It happened when, far to the northeast, the Assyrian Empire began to grow, flex its muscles, and eat up large portions of square mileage. The Assyrians came, and they overran, and they totally conquered the northern of those two nations, Israel. 10/12 of the Jewish people were carried away into exile, far from their homes, and never saw their homes again. And foreign people were transported into the land of Israel. The reason the Assyrians did this was so when they would conquer a nation, they would scatter the people all about so they couldn't gather and revolt and cause trouble. Now think of what it was like if you were Jeremiah and his people living in tiny little Judah, the capital which was Jerusalem, when this had happened some 100 years ago. It would be as if the Chinese came and conquered Canada, New England, and New York State. And we live here in Pennsylvania. What would you think of that? And furthermore, the Assyrians, the Chinese, had made incursions repeatedly into the southern portion of the land, into the land of Judah, and gobbled up territory, and to come back several times, and made life absolutely hard for these people. And Judah, it was tottering on the edge of the cliff of even being existent for many times until God would rescue them. Now, when Jeremiah was born, the particular king, his story is told in both Kings and Chronicles, who ruled was a man named Manasseh. Manasseh was the worst king that Judah ever had, by far the most ungodly. And he reigned for a full 55 years. During his time, here's what happened. Manasseh is living in Pennsylvania, looking up at New York State, Canada. I'm sorry, he's living in Judah, looking up at Israel in the north, all taken over by the Assyrians, and he's scared to death. And so he says, I've got to do something to stay these people off. I've got to come to terms with them. I've got to make friends with them. And so Manasseh makes friends with the Assyrian overlords. He subjects himself to them. He says, I will put Judah at your disposal. We will be a vassal state of yours, but you will be the great overlords. That's well and good. What does that mean? Well, it means that every year, the people of Judah through Manasseh have to send the Assyrians large amounts of money. It also means any vassal state of Assyria, that is, any state that Assyria conquers or that is in subjection to, that leader must own the top Assyrian god as his own personal god and must lead his country to primarily worship that god. The god of the Assyrians was named Asher. So Manasseh said, Asher, it will be. Manasseh goes to the temple of God. You remember which temple we're talking about? The temple Solomon built. The temple that was one of the wonders of the ancient world. The temple which God, on the day it was dedicated, filled with his glory, so shockingly bright that the priests couldn't even get near it for the blazing presence of the Lord. That was the temple that God told all his people to turn to when they would pray for help. This was the temple that the Passover sacrifice did, that all the sacrifices were offered. This was the temple that all the people were to come to 3 times a year and meet God. This was the temple that all the priests ministered into. This temple had a holy place, and inside the holy place was the most holy place where God was actually physically present in a condensed form over top of the Ark of the Covenant, the box that had the Ten Commandments. This was the most holy place, not in Israel, not on earth. This was the most holy place in the universe, the condensed presence of Jehovah God. And then I walked in there, and he says, things are going to change now. And so he began to dismantle all the furnishings that God had told them to put into that temple for his worship. And in their place, in the temple of the Most High God, Manasseh, king of God's people, put up altars to the god Baal. He put up the vile, disgusting, obscene images, and they worshiped them. We read that what Manasseh did was he also began and said, look, I'm going to worship Asher, the god of the Assyrians. And since we're living here in what used to be the land of Canaan, well, let's worship their god too, Baal, just to make sure that we have his favor as well. And since many people think of the moon and the stars and the sun have power over us, let's make sure we worship them too. Things that God had strictly forbidden his people to do. And so he built altars in the temple to worship the stars, sun, and moon that God had flung from a speck into the palm of his hand instead of the one Lord God. We read also that now not only was he sinful in his worship, but he was sinful in his other practices too, because idolatry has a way of ruining a person's soul, whether that god is an idol of wood, stone, or whether that idol is a god of money or pleasure. And so Manasseh began to practice and to dabble and then to dive into the dark arts. He was known for his dalliance in black magic. He was known for his practice of trying to contact the dead and speak to them. He was known for human sacrifices, including the sacrifice of his own sons in order to buy the favor of the gods. He was known for promoting the worship of Baal, the Canaanite god, which worship involved ritual prostitution, because Baal worship was all about fertility, having fertile crops and fertile animals, and so worship must have been fertility, and so you would consort with 10 priests and priestesses who were prostitutes, and that would be the worship service. This was what he did in front of everybody. The Bible says that nobody before him had ever been so wicked. And we read furthermore that the courts were so unjust and twisted and full of bribery at the time that, as God put it in 2 Kings 21:16, Manasseh, quote, shed so much innocent blood that he filled Jerusalem from end to end. You understand what he's talking about? Man A has committed a murder. The powers that be know that Man A has committed a murder. But Man A has paid off the judges. So charges are trumped up against Man B, who's totally innocent. And then he is stoned to death for his murder. This is the kind of thing that went on under Manasseh. It is with this reign in mind and all the sin that God's people have plunged into from following their leader that now God sends the prophet Jeremiah to say a few words about what God might think of all that's going on. It is the darkest hour of Judah's history. And here is the message Jeremiah comes to. He does not stand up and say, I have a message from God. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures and leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. None of that. Here is Jeremiah's message. The Lord God says, I am done. I am done. I am done. Jeremiah, God says repeatedly to the Lord, Jeremiah, do not pray for mercy for these people. I will not hear you. Do not pray for it. I am done. These people are going to be wiped off the face of the earth. That's his message. That's the sermon. Let's all close with a hymn and go home. How do you think he was received when he preached this kind of sermon? They hated the vilified man. They could not stand him. False prophets would stand up and say about how good things were going to be, about how the Lord was going to reverse their fortunes, about how Israel and the north and the south would be reunited, about how Jehovah's favor was about to rise and shine on the country. And Jeremiah says, don't you believe a word of these lying, wicked prophets? They have not heard a word from God. You are going into exile. Don't even think that you can avoid it. It's going to happen to you. And he describes in graphic detail all that's going to happen. He knows in his mind's eye, because God gives He sees what's going to happen at the end. He can picture, as if God or Shay is showing him a movie before it happens, of the siege around Jerusalem that's going to come by the Babylonians that are going to overcome these cities. He sees that the year and a half or so siege that it takes is going to bring starvation in that land. And because starvation is going to be in that land, he sees that cannibalism will happen. And the Bible predicts that even the most delicate woman who will not even touch her bare foot to the sole of the ground will eat her own child because she's so hungry. He sees that on the day the walls are breached, that the Babylonians will come in and they will slit the throats of men, women, and children and rip open pregnant women. He sees, as vividly as the movie you rented this past week, he sees the Babylonians crumbling all the walls and buildings of Jerusalem, setting the place on fire, and then the dignified old men and women, the lovely young women and strong young men, and children shackled with rusty irons and jerked off and marched hundreds of miles away to a land that they don't know the language of, they don't like the climate of, and they will never see their homeland again. He sees that God is going to take the final king of Israel, call him to judgment before the great Babylonian warlord Nebuchadnezzar, and that as judgment for his failing to be a good vassal of the Babylonians, he sees that God is going to have Nebuchadnezzar call the sons of King Zedekiah, the final king of Judah, and kill his sons before his eyes, so the last thing he sees is the death of his sons, and then take a spear and pluck out both of his eyes so that he is chained blind for the rest of his life. Jeremiah sees this, and thus he is called the weeping prophet, because he loves his country the way you love America. Now then, this is the man that we're going to read about. And here is what he says. This is just the beginning little salvo of what he says about the sins that have brought his people to this place. And I just say before we turn to chapter 2 and read very briefly, it will be more brief than what I've said already, that Jeremiah is written in such a way that it's hard to find where he is. It's not an organized book. Unlike Isaiah, where sometimes you can very clearly tell the direction he is going, with Jeremiah, he's all over the map. Things that happened later in real life are recorded early in the book. Things that Jeremiah said early in real life are sometimes recorded later in the book. Whether the word from God is a sentence or two sometimes, or many paragraphs on end sometimes, they're all sort of mixed together, and so it's a little hard to follow where you are. I find it very difficult to preach from this book. I often wonder why the book is organized in such a haphazard, seemingly, way, and so confusing. And I suspect the reason is that it is organized in such a way to mirror the confusion and chaos of the times. Jeremiah, chapter 2, verse 10. Cross over to the coasts of Kittim and look. Send to Gadara and observe closely. See if there has ever been anything like this. As the map on the front wall shows, Kittim is the island of Cyprus in the Mediterranean Sea to the west of Israel and the other islands around it. Kedar is the Arabian desert to the east of Judah and Jerusalem. Bedouin tribes roam there. You could not get more different of the culture of the islands of Cyprus on the Mediterranean and the desert life of the Bedouins to the east. He picks these two places, east and west, as representative of the entire pagan world. Here's what God says. Look to the west, look to the east, see if there has ever been anything like this. Has a nation ever changed its gods, even though they are not gods at all? His point is this. From time immemorial, the Philistines, those pagans that gave us Goliath, the Galut, their god has always been Dagon. That was their god for as long as people can remember. He's their god at the time of the writing of Jeremiah, and he will be their god for as long as there will be Philistines. The god Chemosh was the god of the Moabites for as long as anybody could remember. They never changed from Chemosh into another god. The Canaanites have been serving Baal since time immemorial. Nobody remembers the time when the Canaanites worshipped anybody but Baal. And they're still worshipping Baal. And they'll be worshipping Baal tomorrow. And God says, has a nation ever changed its gods but my people? Have exchanged their glory for worthless idols. What does he mean by their glory? He means himself. It's a capital G, as it were. Here's what he means. Israel did not have many things to boast about on its own. They didn't have much to glory in. They didn't have a larger population than other people. They were a tiny little country. They certainly didn't have a more powerful military than other people. They were relatively few in number when going to war. They didn't have an abundance of natural resources that was the envy of the ancient world. They had to import many of their resources. What was the one thing that made Israel stand out as glorious that would be the envy of the people of the world? It was Jehovah, their God. No other nation of the world had actually had the God of the universe reach down and say, of all the peoples of the world, I pick you to be mine. No other nation of the world had a God come and with 10 mighty plagues put down Pharaoh, the most powerful man on the world, and free them from slavery and bring them into another country owned by someone else. When they left Egypt, no other nation on the face of the earth had ever had a deity that led them by an enormous pillar of cloud during the day and fire during the night to light the way. And when they came to the Red Sea in front of them and they couldn't go anywhere else, this slave ragtag group of some 2 million and Pharaoh's elite charioteers were behind them ready to cut their throat because Pharaoh had had second thoughts about letting the Israelites go. Well then, no other nation had had it that the pillar left in front of the Israelites and moved to the rear of the Israelite king. And all that night, the Egyptians saw that pillar only abject darkness that made it impossible for them to maneuver. While the Israelites on their side saw the light of a blazing fire as God parted the Red Sea, had them safely pass over. In the morning, when Pharaoh's army chased them, the most prime military organization on the face of the earth drowned as slaves who didn't know how to fight climbed onto the other side. No other nation had had this pillar of cloud and fire lead them through the desert. How are you going to feed 2 million people in the desert? How long can they carry a knapsack full of stuff? So God gives them manna on the ground every day. How are you going to give enough water to drink to 2 million people going through the driest spot for many miles around? God is going to make water come out of the rock. How are you going to have these people who are not trained in war take over the land of Canaan with cities that are walled up to the sky and with trained soldiers and with a military that is daunting and people that are large in stature? Well, God is going to part the Jordan River at flood stage so the Israelites can cross over. God is going to make the walls of Jericho tumble down into dust before the Israelites even lift a sword. God is going to make thunder and lightning and hail come down upon poor Canaanite soldiers, and he's going to give the land of Israel to his people, the Jews. God is going to have them build a temple, and when he enters that temple, he will fill it with such blazing glory no one can get near it for the sight. This was the glory of Israel. This is the one thing that made them stand out more than any other nation in the world. All the nations around absolutely saw this. The Egyptians knew it had happened. The Bedouins who were hiding in the crags and peeled the cliffs in the desert as God led them through, they knew about it. The Moabites knew about it. The Philistines knew about it. The Canaanites knew about it. Everybody knew that God was their one unshakable glory. And they decided to trade him in. And what did they trade him in? They traded him in on idols that are described like this in the books of the prophets. A man goes out into the forest and finds a tree. It is good, he says to himself. So he cuts down the tree and begins to carve it, and he shapes an idol. Then he says to himself, I must dress it with gold and silver. So he pays a silversmith or goldsmith to tap gold onto the external surface of the idol. Then his wife whips sews up some clothes, and he puts the clothes on the idol. And then he bows down to the idol. Oh, but first he must pick it up and carry it to the spot, because he cannot walk himself. These idols have eyes, God says, but they cannot see. They have ears, but they cannot hear. They have mouths, but they can't say a word. And Israel traded God for a hunk of wood that they had to make. And therefore God says in verse 2, be appalled at this, O heavens, and shudder with great horror, declares the Lord. This is unthinkable disloyalty. Pagans wouldn't even do this. You just don't do that to any god, let alone to this God. Now God goes on, verse 13. My people have committed two sins. They have forsaken me, the spring and living water, and have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns, that cannot hold water. You see what he's doing. He's comparing himself and the idols that they are serving to two different sources of water. On the one hand is a cistern. Now, we generally don't have cisterns here in the United States. What they are is underground tanks to hold water. In a dry climate, where it only rains at certain times of the year, you need to collect all the water you can during rainy season so that during the dry season you can survive. And so they would dig a room underground, a chamber of some sort. It could be fairly wide. They would line it with plaster, but then when it came up to the surface of the ground, the room would constrict and it would just be a narrow hole so the water would evaporate out there. You'd collect the rain and whatever kind of gutters or containers you could and pour it in there, and then it would store. What's it like to drink water from a cistern? Oh, it's just great. It's sitting in there stagnant. It generally had worms. It was tepid, lukewarm, dust collected on the top. Someone who saw water from a cistern said it has the appearance of pale soap suds. And then what happens is the plaster eventually breaks, and then mud seeps up from underneath, and the water is covered with dirt and mud particles all the way through it. God says, that's what your idols are like. Now he says, think what it was like to worship me. He said, I am a spring of living water. I am like what happens to the north of you. You see that mountain, Mount Hermon up there, it's visible from a large part of Israel. Mount Hermon is snow-capped all year round. All that snow melts. It goes underground, and then in various places it comes up in a spring, and it's cold. And it's clear, and it's moving, and it tastes wonderful. He says, you give up a spring for this. You give up me for that. He goes on. Chapter 2, verse 32. Does a maid forget her jewelry, or a bride, her wedding ornaments? Yet my people have forgotten me, days without number. One of the benefits of being a minister is the ability to conduct weddings and the front row seat you have to weddings. I have conducted endless weddings from this platform and from the platform of the old sanctuary and at other churches, and I can tell you that there was not a single member of the family, not the best man, not the bride's favorite girl, not the parents of the bride or groom, nobody has a better view of that wedding than whatever fortunate minister is conducting that ceremony. I stand here. I can reach over and touch the shoulder of the groom as he says his vows. I can stand here and touch the shoulder of that bride, and I can see the nuances on their face as they make their vows. It's a priceless privilege to do this. And I can tell you, having watched many, many brides on their wedding day, this is the day they remember. And they remember what they wore. And they remember the jewelry that they had. And they remember all the accoutrements to make them lovely on that day. He said a bride would never forget these things. But, he said, I am the one who made the bride so lovely, who gave her the groom so handsome and able. I'm the one who made the materials on the earth from which the dress was made and the jewelry was carved. I'm the one who invented all this stuff. And yet, she will not forget her dress and her ornaments, but you forget me. Jeremiah 2, verse 1. What does this forgetting look like? The word of the Lord came to me, Jeremiah, go and proclaim in the hearing of Jerusalem, quote, now God is speaking, I remember the devotion of your youth, how as a bride you loved me and followed me through the desert, through a land not sown. You know what he's talking about. He's talking about the honeymoon that Israel and Jehovah had when he first freed them from Egypt. He grabs her by the hand and says, come, let's get out of this place, let's blow this joint, and let's go have a good time. And so he takes them through the desert and provides for their needs. People have noticed that between the time they left Israel, Egypt, and the time they arrived at Mount Sinai, there was not a single hint of Israel ever tipping even the slightest nod toward foreign gods. They complained at times, they dragged their feet at times, but they never thought about another god during that time. He says, that was what it was like, your devotion to me in your youth. You loved me and you followed me. There's a country song. It's sung by a number of different female singers. Crystal Gayle sang it. Judy Collins sang it. All the women have sung it. It's called Someday Soon. And it's about this very dynamic. The words go something like this. There's a young man that I know whose age is 21. He's riding in tonight from California. My parents cannot stand him because he rides the rodeo. My father says that he will leave me crying. I would follow him right down the road if he's running out of the room. Someday soon, going with him, someday soon. You see what she's saying? Her dad doesn't want him to marry this boy. Her mom doesn't like the boy. He has a tough life to follow. He's on the rodeo. He's going to be going from place to place. I don't care, she said. I would follow this guy absolutely anywhere. God says, that's the way it used to be with you and me. You followed me through places no other nation would ever walk because you said, that's the God I want to go with. I was your husband. You were my bride. And now, he says, you have forgotten me. There are many things Jeremiah would say about these people and sins to warn us about. But today the one we looked at is that he says, despite all I've done for you and what you had in me, you have forgotten me. So I'd like to ask you this. If you are a Christian, you can probably relate to this at least in a minor way. Can you remember those of you who were converted when you were old enough to recall, say their teenage years or adult years, the sweet taste in your mouth when you first believed in Jesus and realized your sins would never be held against you. Oh, what a sweet taste. Compare it to perhaps what the last month has been, a week, or a year. Have you found that following God through the desert has become difficult enough that at times you just lose the love that you had when you were on your honeymoon with him? Or if you became a believer when you were a child and have been a Christian most of your life, can you not remember times when he was sweet to you, when you read the Bible and it just felt good, when you sang his praises at a worship service somewhere, and it just came out of your mouth on a day, and the music was honey in your mouth, sweet to your soul? And do you find now it's hard to serve him? That's okay. It can be hard at times. But what he's asking is, are you tempted to actually trade me in on something else? Are there things in this world that are appealing enough to you that you're toying with abandoning me for them? He says, and I quote from the Living Bible, you're nuts. He says, think about what that difference is. That's what he's asking you to do. Now, Jeremiah's message is almost totally negative. But surely you know that it's not negative because his message to Judah is necessarily his message to you. You remember what his message to Judah is? I'm done with you. You have sinned so much for for so long and resisted me for so long, I am done. Do not pray for their forgiveness, and I will not forgive this people. That's his message to Judah. But he told Jeremiah to record that message on a scroll so that you could read it. Why? It's because that doesn't want to be his message to you. He wants you to see what he told those people so that you, in contrast, would remember the sweetness of what Jesus has done for you and the time of your honeymoon when it was blissful to you, to encourage you not to be lured away by the things that lured these people away. He's telling you this because it is not his intention to abandon you and send you into exile. It is his intention to give you grace to persevere so that you may be eternally in bliss with him. That's what he wants from this book. And finally, I want to say this. Since the primary sin we have mentioned today is the sin of forgetting him, may I mention the only cure that is mentioned in the book of Jeremiah for such sins? For people who have forgotten their God, as perhaps some of us have here today, the only hope is found in Jeremiah chapter 31. And that hope is that God also forgets. Here's the way he puts it, Jeremiah 31:31. The time has come, declares Jehovah, when I will make a new agreement with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. It will not be like the agreement I made with their forefathers back when I took them by the hand and lead them out of Egypt, because they broke my agreement, although I was a husband to them, says the Lord. But this is the covenant I will make with them after that time, speaking of our day. I will put my law in their minds. I will write my law on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people. And no longer will a man teach his neighbor, saying, you need to know the Lord, because they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord. Here's the sentence. For I will forgive their wickedness and will remember their sins no more. Do you hear what he says then? The God whose mind is airtight, who locks in everything that's ever been said or done or thought, is absolutely more than willing through the blood of Jesus to make himself, as it were, forget that you have forgotten him. This is the sweet well of spring water that invites you to love him and worship him and to leave your lukewarm, warm-filled, cisternary water of all the alternatives that draw you and to come to him and to drink and be satisfied. Would you take a moment of silence and speak to God about whatever is running through your thoughts from the book of Jeremiah? Finally, right after this service, as we do once a month, we're having a welcome lunch for any people who are relatively new, whether you're here for the first time, you haven't gotten to know many people yet, you get to meet a pastor, which is not much of a draw, you get lunch, which is pretty good, and you can ask any questions you have. It's a no obligation, there's no pressure to join the church or give money or anything like that. It's just to get to know us a little bit better. Please feel free to come, bring your children, your grandmother, your distant uncle as well. And nice to have you. May the Lord bless you, keep you. May the Lord make his face shine on you. May the Lord grant you peace.